Please be seated.
Our second case this morning is United States against Bartlett. Counsel for the defense.
May it please the court. My name is Captain Candace White Halverson, and together with Colonel Christopher O'Brien, we represent the appellant, Lieutenant Colonel David Bartlett. Army Regulation 2710 contradicts 10 U.S.C. Section 825 because it impermissibly limits the pool of officers from which a convening authority may select a court-martial panel. And in this case, appellant was denied his right to be sentenced by a properly constituted panel. The standard this court should apply in looking at whether a regulation and a statute conflict was set forth by the Supreme Court in Chevron.
Why? Has this court ever cited Chevron?
This court has not ever cited
Chevron. So why should we apply Chevron deference?
Well, Chevron apply because in this case you have a congressional statute conflicting with a regulation. And the Article I courts are set up as a congressional mandate. And so it's the same rationale of the different cases that have applied the Chevron standard.
Isn't internal military decision-making granted a whole different standard of deference on review by the court, by the Article III courts? Leave us out of it for the moment. What is the actual serious applicability of a case like Chevron, which has to do with agency decision-making under the Clean Air Act, in a case like this where you're dealing with the authority of the Secretary of the Army to internally regulate the Army, a subject which has been granted enormous deference by the Article III courts?
Yes, well, Chevron does provide a good framework to look at, because the first question that Chevron asks is whether or not there is a, whether or not the statute is clear. So if there is a clear mandate by Congress on a particular process, then even if the court doesn't apply the exact Chevron standard, certainly the rationale behind Chevron is a good one to choose in looking at statutory interpretation. And so that first question that the court should look at is definitely whether the statute is ambiguous or whether it is clear on its face applying the traditional rules of statutory construction. Then the second question
is the statute clear on its face?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is the statute clear on its face?
Absolutely. The statute is absolutely clear on its face. There is no ambiguity within it at all.
There's no ambiguity to the term best qualified, in your view?
There is not, because this.
So does that mean that the commander who is picking court-martial has to know the qualifications of every member of the armed forces and determine which ones are best qualified to sit on that particular court-martial?
Absolutely not, because the statute also says that it is in his opinion who is best qualified.
Well, but in his opinion, he has to apply the statute. And if the word best qualified is not ambiguous, then why does he not, in exercising his opinion, have to assess the qualifications of all members of the armed forces? How could he possibly use his judgment or his opinion to determine who is best without knowing the qualifications of everyone?
Because he is supposed to apply the factors, the specific factors that, again, are set forth unambiguously in the statute, the age, education, training, experience, length of service, and judicial temperament. So it's based on his knowledge and his knowledge of the people within the pool that he's considering of who those people are.
Well, it doesn't say that on the face of the statute. Again, I'm going to your assertion that we have to look at the statute, and the statute isn't ambiguous. The statute on his face says, shall detail as members thereof such members of the armed forces as, in his opinion, are best qualified. How can you determine who's best in any competition or comparison without knowing the entire pool?
Because again, it's looking at who in his opinion is best qualified.
But if he's not looking at an entire class of people, not because he's concerned with their qualifications, but because he's concerned that it's not convenient, how is he making the determination that the statute requires?
I'm not trying to understand your question, Your Honor.
Well, is the reason that these classes of officers were removed from the pool of permissible court members because they're not qualified, or is it because it's not convenient to have them serve as court martial members?
Well, there's really no true explanation as to why they were removed from the consideration of the convening authority. But the bottom line is that the convening authority is the one established by Congress to make that determination, and not the Secretary of the Army, in the plain language of Section 825. So within the plain language of that statute, it's the convening authority who is to make that determination as to who's best qualified, and then if it is not convenient at any particular given time for them to serve, then there is a provision under Section 825 that those particular members may be excused from particular court-martials for any given time if that is the, in the opinion of the convening authority, again, as set forth in the language of Section 825. Congress also delineated with it, and again, going toward that, Congress considered that the convening authority is responsible for determining who is to sit on courts-martial panel. Congress also delineated specifically the limitations on the convening authority, and specifically laid that out within the plain language of the regulation. So a convening authority cannot appoint anyone who is an accuser or who is a government witness in the case or who has served as an investigating officer or has served as counsel. Convening authority also cannot detail an enlisted service member who's in the same unit as the accused, and also generally cannot appoint anyone junior in rank to the accused. So again, Congress was very clear in the language, within the language of the statute, as to the factors that a convening authority is to consider and the limitations on the convening authority when setting forth who he or she is going to detail to their court-martial panels. Further, Congress also contemplated the role of the service secretaries within the language of the statute and did not detail in the plain language of the statute that convening authorities are to establish further limitations on the pool of officers that the convening authority is to consider. What Congress did do was set forth the role of the Secretary of the Army in subsection E of the statute, where the convening authority can promulgate particular regulations about how a convening authority is to excuse particular panel members. So Congress clearly contemplated the role of the Secretary of the Army in this process, and it was limited to the part in subsection E where the convening authority can set forth the provisions on how a convening authority is to excuse particular panel members from participating in a particular case.
Well, let's assume that you're correct. Where's the prejudice in this case?
Well, the first point is that appellant is not required to show prejudice here because the failure of the convening authority to be able to consider all of the potential members that would be, in his opinion, best qualified was a structural error in this case. And so because it rose to a structural defect in the constitution of a trial, it's inherently prejudicial without a need to show.
Well, in all the cases in which we've found that, haven't those been cases in which there's been a specific determination to exclude certain persons or classes of persons from court-martial service as the basis for that determination?
And that's
in this case, we have a variety of regulations, the purpose of which is not exclusion of members from courts-martial, but rather assignment of duties for particular classes of individuals. And those regulations talk about service other than courts-martial that those individuals are excluded from. So if we were to review the service secretary's action in this case, not as a effort to exclude certain classes of people from courts-martial service, but to regulate the types of service that certain classes of individuals can do, why would we necessarily find this to be a structural error?
Because the effect of what the Secretary of the Army has done is prohibiting a certain class of people from participating in courts-martial. Your question kind of implicates subsection 3013, where the Secretary of the Army is authorized to detail the duties of certain
right, and the regulations that we're dealing with here are not court-martial regulations, nor are they focused solely on court-martial service, but they talk about a variety of duties that these individuals can't perform.
What happens is that you've got Section 3013, which does give the Secretary of the Army that broad discretion to prescribe duties for military members. But you also have Section 825, which is a very specific statute that talks about how court-martials are to be convened. And so when you have a statute that gives a broad grant of authority contrasted with one that gives a very specific grant of authority, that specific statute cannot be nullified or contradicted by
that. That wasn't my question. My question was, assuming that it was error, why should we apply a structural error concept in a circumstance where, on the face of the rule, it appears to be a rule directed generally towards the service of individuals, as opposed to a rule in which someone is trying to affect the structure of courts martial?
Because ultimately it does affect the structure of the court-martial. And applying the standard from the Supreme Court test and that this court applied in Brooks in testing for structural error, that this fits under that first prong of, because a convening authority is unable to truly consider the pool of panel members that he believes are most qualified to serve on his panel, it amounts to a structural error in the process, in the constitution of the court-martial from beginning to end. And there's a difficulty in really assessing the true effect of that, as was determined by the Supreme Court and by this court in Brooks. And so the effect of the regulations promulgated by the Secretary of the Army have that effect of creating the structural error in the fundamental constitution of appellant's court-martial, such that it rises to the level of a structural error. However, if this court finds that there is not a structural error but does require a test for prejudice, the appellant was prejudiced in this case. Because the factors that a convening authority is to consider in subsection 825, age, experience, education, line up very well with the prohibited branches set up in Army Regulation 2710. Doctors and nurses and veterinarians and chaplains have that extreme experience based on their particular duties, but also their role in the military community. They also have, they're very well educated, and appellant was denied their particular characteristics and factors on his court-martial panel.
Is appellant arguing that the panel that actually heard his case was not qualified under Article 25?
No, appellant's not contending that at all. Appellant agrees that does not contest that the panel members that were chosen were qualified under the required rules for court-martial, and that the convening authority did personally select those.
You've made a substantive and a procedural argument. Turning to the procedural aspect of it, if a convening authority exempted the same persons from a court-martial, would you object to that?
Yes, Your Honor. A convening authority cannot do a blanket exemption of particular classes of people or groups of people, again, under the language of Section 825.
What if he said that based on training and experience, they didn't have training and experience in the combat arms, and therefore were not well suited to make judgments about events that may have occurred in combat?
I mean, if in the convening authority's personal opinion, those particular officers were not qualified, then of course the appellant would not contest it.
So as a matter of substance, you distinguish between specific application versus generalized application?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
What if the convening authority decided that based on mission requirements they weren't going to detail certain classes of people or a certain person to a court-martial? Do you think that that's permissible?
If the convening authority felt that, for example, there was a particular veterinarian that was best qualified and looking at the officers that he was considering for appointing to a court-martial panel, that a veterinarian was best qualified, but at that given time, mission required that veterinarian participate in another duty, then that convening authority could excuse that panel member for a particular time under subsection E. So there is a mechanism within the statute of Section 825 that allows for a convening authority to take those particular factors into consideration, which was exactly the rationale behind having the convening authority be the person responsible for appointing those court-martial members.
That's not what Section 825E says.
I'm sorry?
Section 825E says that before the court-martial is convened, the convening authority may excuse a member of the court-martial. I believe the question was, can the convening authority not select someone who is best qualified, never make them a member of a court-martial? And that, again, if we're talking about reading the literal words narrowly of the statute as opposed to reading it broadly, it would appear that the convening authority does not have the power to not select the best qualified person just because that person has an important military duty, if we were to read the statute narrowly.
Correct, and that's exactly...
Has this court ever read the statute that way to say that a convening authority can't non-select, in fact, not select the person who would otherwise be best qualified if that person has an important duty?
I can't point to a particular case, but
under E, what you're suggesting is that the convening authority must select them, put them on the convening order, and then have it be basically an empty gesture because they're going to turn around then and excuse them from the court martial.
Well, and again, if in the convening authority's opinion that that person is best qualified, that is who they are to appoint to their court martial panel members, and that's the. That's the plain reading of the statute, and then it does have the provision for excusing them for a particular court-martial if the mission requirements require that they participate, that they are detailed to do some other duty.
We don't have to decide any of these issues for this case, but the question, I guess the distinction that you're making is whether the convening authority can make the decision or not, the Secretary of the Army can.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Because that is the role of the convening authority as laid out in the plain language of Section 825. And again, the rationale for that is because convening authorities are the ones in the best position to ensure the efficient operation of their particular units. Appellant cited in the brief, the 1999 Joint Services Committee report succinctly stated that the military commander is responsible for the efficient operation of his or her unit, and as the convening authority is in the best position to select members based on their availability and qualifications that are consistent with Article 25. And that is the purpose behind behind Section 825, was that it's the convening authorities who make that decision. And that was taken away. The convening authority did not have the opportunity to consider all available panel members in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, my name is Captain Sarah Rakowski, and along with Major Elizabeth Morata, I represent the United States government in this matter. The Secretary of the Army's decision to exempt officers of the special branches from court-martial service does not contradict Article 25 for two reasons. Congress authorized the Secretary of the Army to manage the resources of the Army via policy and regulation.
Counsel. One of the canons of statutory construction is that when you've got a narrow, explicit statute dealing precisely with the subject matter and a broad grant of authority, the narrow statute trumps the broad grant. Article 25 specifically deals with the qualifications of members of courts martial. 3013 is a general grant of authority to run the Army to the Secretary. How can you say that 3013 trumps 25?
3013 does not trump Article 25, Your Honor. What 3013 does is work in conjunction with Article 25. So the fact that the Secretary's authority is not, the lack of referral to the Secretary of the Army in Article 25 and the government's construction, there is a gap in Article 25 dealing with the detailing court-martial members. And therefore, the Secretary, by authority...
Well, how do you answer the point made by the appellant that 25 occupies the field because it lists specific excluded classes, and that therefore Congress has occupied the field and the Secretary of the Army can't expand on what Congress did?
The Secretary has not expanded on what Congress did, Your Honor.
I don't read physicians, nurses, et cetera, in Article 25. I read accusers, you know, and others. Accusers, witnesses, investigating officers, and counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. Congress put those in there. Congress didn't put anything else in there, nor did Congress, except if you read 3013 as the way you want to read it, grant the authority of the Secretary to do that.
Yes, Your Honor. This is a question, the primary question in this case is a question of administrative availability, which is the Secretary's determination is that these officers are administratively unavailable versus their legal eligibility. And the reason that 3013 does not contradict Article 25 is that the Secretary's action based on his authority in 3013 does not change the remaining and continuing eligibility legally of these officers under Article 25 to serve on courts martial.
What's the limit to that argument? Could the Secretary, therefore, as in a matter of administrative authority, say, well, gee, we're in conflict now. Nobody serving in the combat arms may serve on a court martial. As the government's argument would seem to say, that's fine. That's an administrative determination.
Your Honor, there are limits to the Secretary's authority. If this court looks to the standard established in Rollins v. Georgia, which is a state case administrative, or it's a Supreme Court case discussing accepted state practice, but the Rollins decision held that exemptions based on the need for the individual services in the community, their uninterrupted services, exemption is appropriate as long as they are not exempting protected classes and also a sufficient number of unexceptionable persons remain present for service, and if we alter the opinion to fit this case, for courts martial. So not trials, but court martial. So in this case, if this court relies on the Supreme Court precedent in Rollins, then the Secretary can exempt based on the needs of his service under his authority as the Secretary of the Army, as this court held in United States versus Hosing. He can make those decisions for the needs of his service, but he cannot completely deprive appellant of the right to a trial by an impartial jury.
Well, I take that to mean, in the government's view, the Secretary could exempt all members of the arm, of the combat arms from serving on court martials. Is that what you're arguing today?
Potentially, yes, sir.
It appears you're also arguing that in a case of dereliction of duty involving medical malpractice, if the convening authority, we had a few of those cases before this court, if the convening authority were to determine that a medical officer would be best qualified to serve on that court-martial, he could not do so because the Secretary would have put a block in his way.
The convening authority, yes, Your Honor. To your basic question, yes. I would like to add the caveat that if a convening authority...
The yes is yes what?
Yes, Your Honor, but...
No, but what are you saying yes to?
Yes, the convening authority, based on the current valid regulations promulgated by the Secretary of the Army, if a convening authority wants to add a member of the medical corps, I believe you said medical officer, sir, so if it...
I'm just quoting from the regulation, MC officer's duties.
Yes.
Yeah.
Your Honor, the medical corps are, there is no exception for medical corps officers.
Right.
In the regulations, Army nurses, members of the Army Nurse Corps and members of the Medical Specialist Corps may serve as members on court martial.
That wasn't my question. I was referring to medical corps. Yeah. The medical corps officers regulation.
The medical corps officers regulation would not permit a convening authority to appoint a member of the medical corps to a court.
And how does that comport with Congress's intent that convening authorities will be in the best position to decide in a particular case which of the officers would be best qualified to serve as the decision makers in that case?
A convening authority is permitted to request an exemption. There's nothing, there is a a history, at least, of exceptions being granted at the request of convening authorities to those regulations. So it
is that a matter on which we can take judicial notice or is otherwise established in the record of this case?
It is a matter, the documentation is not in evidence before this court, but it is a fact this court could take judicial notice of.
And where would we find that fact? You may consult with your co-counsel if you'd like.
Your Honor, I cannot point to a specific portion of the regulation where granting the convening authority to request an exemption. So with that said, it's possible the court may not want to take judicial notice.
Thank you.
If we disagree with you that the Army regulation is valid, can you turn to your views as to how we test this, whether it's we presume prejudice, test for prejudice, what's the test?
Your Honor, the test, the government's position is that this is not structural error. If any error is found, it is not to the level of a structural error. And that is, there are the two tests, and the appellant has indicated that they are only arguing the first prong of the test, which is where prejudice is difficult to assess. I want to make two points. The first point is that the case appellant cites, Arizona v. Fulminante, lists a line of cases. And as Your Honor, I think Judge Efron pointed out.
I was asking a question, yeah.
Correct. That there are no cases where the single case, the Vasquez case, referred to exclusion of a protected class from a grand jury. We don't have protected classes in this case. And then as to the difficulty of assessing the error, in fact, the Army Court in this case did assess the error and find that the individuals not selected, the medical personnel in particular, would not have been more sympathetic to appellant's arguments at this sentencing hearing based on the volume of the evidence, the graphicness of the autopsy, and the photographs. So the Army Court did, in fact, assess prejudice. Therefore, the government's position is it is not difficult to assess.
Well, I mean, I think you're probably better off relying on the military judge's findings of fact with respect to the concessions made by defense counsel as opposed to the speculation of the CCAs to something that's really pretty unknowable.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, under Article 36, the responsibility for promulgating rules for the governor's court-martial isn't lodged in the service secretary. It's lodged in the president. And he's done that in the manual. He's done that in the RCM. If you look at Rule 502, which 502A, of course, tracks Article 25, and you look at 502 seems to give a very expansive view of who can serve on courts-martial. It basically says, tracks the requirements set out in Article 25, age, education, training, experience, length of service, and judicial temperament. Speaks of commissioned officers, warrant officers, and enlisted persons. And then if you look at the discussion in 502, it includes retirees if they're serving on active duty. It includes reservists if they're serving on active duty. And it even includes persons who are not members of the armed forces, but are members of the uniformed services if they're serving with components of the armed forces. Doesn't that indicate a presidential finding that 25 ought to be read expansively and thus undercut the secretary's determination that it ought to be read narrowly?
Your Honor, anyone under Article 25 who has the ability to manage the Army's resources, and that includes the President, has the authority that the Secretary of the Army is asserting in this situation. 502 is actually 502 comports with the government's position that it is more than simply the factors listed in Article 25 from which that affect who is who will serve on courts martial and who will be selected. So
how does it?
It reflects additional factors that may be considered.
Such as?
Well, simply put, I believe that Article 25 refers to those actual service on individuals who are actually on active duty or subject to Article 25. And the members of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration are potentially, they're eligible to serve, but there's no language like that specifically in Article 25. So if we read Article 25 as narrowly as appellant would like us to read it, that would seem to conflict with that discussion portion of 502, if I'm making my point.
Is your point that members of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Service or the Public Health Service are not commissioned officers?
Correct, sir.
And what would be the basis for that assertion?
Or they are not necessarily, they are not necessarily commissioned officers because I believe that civilians can actually work in those particular administrations.
Right, but the statute only says commissioned officers, right?
And
so under what theory could the convening authority appoint a civilian to serve on a court-martial? Does the president expressly authorize this in Rule 502?
I don't believe so, sir.
Okay. Now, in terms of deference, what standard of deference should we apply? And I ask that in light of the Supreme Court's varied application of Chevron, for example, in tax cases, where the Supreme Court is dealing with a general authority of the secretary to issue regulations. Chevron deference generally has not been applied as opposed to a specific grant of substantive authority. Why should we apply Chevron deference here?
This court, the Supreme Court applies substantial deference to an agency's interpretation of its own regulations. So this is the Army interpreting its own regulation. Article 25 affects the Army. The Army interprets it via the Secretary in promulgating the regulations.
But the statute that's being affected is Article 25, not Section 3013. How does a general authority under 3013 enable the Secretary of the Army to interpret a provision of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, a statute that has specific provisions, specific delegation authority under Article 36, which has not been subdelegated here to the Secretary of the Army, and which was established to provide uniformity among the armed forces. This would allow each service to have different rules and a lack of uniformity on a critical matter, that is the matter that's the substitute for service members' Sixth Amendment rights.
I'm sorry, sir, could you repeat your...
Yeah. That is, the question is, how does the Secretary of the Army get to authorize a rule when we're dealing with the Uniform Code of Military Justice that's affected? The Uniform Code of Military Justice has a specific provision, Article 25, that will be affected by this. It has a specific delegation of authority provision, Article 36, in which the President has not delegated any authority to the Secretary of the Army. And the provision that's being affected, Article 25, is the substitute for service members' Sixth Amendment right to trial by jury. So in the end, when we would result with different rules among different services, a lack of uniformity, contrary to the purpose of the UCMJ, why should the service secretaries be allowed to do that?
National security is the paramount concern of both the United States and the Uniform Code of Military Justice. In order to promote national security, the secretary in this case has the authority, primarily to promote and improve national security, secure it. And if he cannot secure it, that is the reason this court has determined that service members do not, they have limited Sixth Amendment rights. And so it is that standard under which the secretary believes that he has the authority to determine that certain service members in certain specific special branches are unavailable. But he has not affected their right to a fair, impartial, and a fair, impartial panel. And in fact, there's no indication that the individuals that were chosen were not qualified.
So it's the government's position that the secretary can exercise his or her administrative authority in any way that the secretary wants to, even if it changes the impact of the UCMJ, so long as the secretary is doing it for national security reasons?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Counsel, does the secretary, does it appear on the record what the policies of the other, of Secretary of the Navy or Secretary of the Air Force are in this area?
Yes, Your Honor. The secretary,
and what are they?
Your Honor, the Secretary of the Air Force and the Secretary of the Navy exempt chaplains, and that is direction, I believe they're both instructions from each secretary, so they're clearly the secretary's intent. The fact that the Secretary of the Air Force and the Secretary of the Navy exempt anyone at all adds significant support to the Secretary of the Army's decision.
Aren't chaplains statutorily unique? Under 10 U.S.C. 3581, they have rank without command. No other category of officers exercise rank without command. Under 10 U.S.C. 643, they can be discharged or retired summarily if they lose their ecclesiastical qualifications. Nobody else has got that. Isn't that a statutory basis for setting chaplains apart that does not exist in the case of the medical personnel whom the Secretary of the Army is exempting and no one else does?
There is statutory, no, Your Honor. The other special branches are specifically and statutorily named special, determined special under 3065, which details what their duties are.
It details their professional
and their
duties.
Professional duties and the fact that they are different from the other branches discussed in appellant's brief, and like chaplains, essentially, their duties cannot be performed by individuals who have not received that training, that education, and that experience.
Do they exercise rank without command?
No, they do not. But the Inspector General's branch serves as an impartial fact finder. And to pull them in, as the Secretary states in their regulation, exempting them from court-martial service, to pull them into court-martial service would make them an instrument of the command, which they cannot be. If they are to remain,
can't you leave that up the military? Can't you leave that up the military judge without exempting them as classes?
The secretary's determination is that the needs of the Army require these individuals be at their duties and not subject to even being called for voir dire,
okay.
Selected for
a determination with which the Secretary of the Air Force and the Secretary of the Navy do not concur in the case of their own services.
That is correct, but as I believe Judge Efron pointed out, the Congress has never required uniformity across the armed forces, and each secretary is permitted to promulgate regulations to meet the needs of his service as determined by him. So it's a secretary.
Chief Judge may have asked this, has the President delegated the authority to set qualifications for members of courts martial under Article 36 to the service secretaries?
No, he has not, but what he has done is Congress gave the Secretary the authority to manage the resources.
And that gets me back to my original question, which is the narrow statute versus the broad grant of authority. But we won't go through that again.
You may briefly conclude.
Thank you. The Secretary's decision to exempt officers of the special branches from Article 25 does not contradict Article 25 for two reasons. Congress authorized the Secretary to manage the resources of the Army via policy and regulation. An exemption of these personnel is a reasonable exercise of his authority under 3013, balancing the needs of the Army and the individual rights of service members. Appellant received a fair sentencing hearing by panel members properly detailed under Article 25 and was therefore not prejudiced. For these reasons, this honorable court should affirm the Army Court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Counsel, before you start, in the military judge's finding of fact number 9, he or she says that the defense has alleged no specific prejudice and goes on to say the defense doesn't contend that these officers weren't just as qualified as the people that were actually detailed or that they were excluded for any impermissible purpose. In light of those facts, which the defense agreed to at trial, under what theory would we test that, would we use, find structural error in this case?
Again, because the military judge did not consider the structural error question, but the truth is it did exist here because of the effect of the Secretary of the Army's regulations that from the beginning to the end of appellant's court-martial, the convening authority was deprived of the opportunity to consider the officers that were prohibited from his consideration under the regulations. So that action by the Secretary of the Army amounted to a structural error because he was not able to truly appoint to his court-martial panel those who, in his opinion, were necessarily the best qualified. So I guess the panel's position is that there wasn't a need to test for prejudice in that case because of that structural error.
I mean, I guess structural error is found very rarely, right? When it strikes at the very heart of the integrity of the court martial itself.
Yes,
and when you have a situation where there's a concession on the record that it was a fair court martial.
Well,
I mean, I'm just asking, don't you see some inconsistency there?
There was a fair court martial in terms of the fact that when the convening authority did consider the officers that he was allowed to consider, there was no kind of violation such as like would rise to a jurisdictional type of violation. The convening authority did appoint he did personally select the panel members. He did use the factors as set up in Article 25 for the members that he could consider.
And they were fair and they were qualified and the other people were not excluded for any impermissible reason.
For any impermissible reason by the convening authority, but by the Secretary of the Army, by his action of limiting the panel members that the convening authority could consider, it necessarily affected the whole structure of the court-martial because he couldn't consider those particular people and may have been, in his opinion, best qualified to serve on his panel. And so under the analysis from the Supreme Court in Brooks in that first prong, it's impossible to test truly what the prejudice.
Do you agree that the Secretary of the Army, that the regulation excludes those classes of people not for any reason of attempting to influence the outcome of a court-martial or because they're considered to be more or less lenient, but for purposes of asset management and feasibility and control of assets that the Army has?
Appellant certainly does not contest that it was an improper purpose, but there's also no evidence in the record truly as to why those people were exempted, that there is no explanation either in the record or within the language of the statute that there was a need to exempt medical officers or veterinarians from the court-martial process and from sitting in court-martial panels.
Counsel, if we were to agree with you that there was structural error in this case, what would be the effect then on all of the court-martials that the Army has held prior to this time where they've excluded these classes of officers?
Sure. I'm out of time. May I answer?
You've got time to answer that question.
This does not rise to the. This is a. Appellant contends it's a structural error, but not a jurisdictional error. So it must be raised at trial. This is an issue that must be preserved under Crawford, and so therefore would only affect cases where this was an issue preserved at trial, and respectfully, Your Honor, any decision that this court makes is going to affect pending cases and cases currently in trial, and they will there will be some repercussions, and it will affect the cases, but they will adjust to it, Your Honor. Subject to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted. This concludes the court's regularly scheduled arguments for this term. And on this occasion, we'd like to thank all counsel who have participated in the court's hearings for the year, for your contributions to the military justice system, and for your service to the men and women of the armed forces. Court now may be adjourned.
The court stands adjourned until further order of the court.